Hello and welcome to this week's show, The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is May 4th, 2005. I'm your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. With me, as always, is Perry DeAngelis.
Hello.
Evan Bernstein.
Hello, everyone.
And my skeptical brothers, Bob Novella.
Hello.
And Jay Novella.
Great to be here.
On this weekly skeptical podcast, or Skepticast as we call it, we talk about all things paranormal, controversial, pseudoscientific, fringe science, the borderlands of science. We cover it all. So about a few days ago, I was listening to NPR, and they have a new program that they're doing called What I Believe. And it's essays by famous people talking about what they believe most. And by coincidence, I was thinking, you know, if I had to sum up what I believe in a sentence, as they were, I would say that I believe in truth. And just as I was thinking that, this week's essayist opened up by saying, I believe in truth and the pursuit of truth, which I thought was not only coincidental but perfect. The essayist turned out to be Errol Morris. You all remember who this is?
No, not at all.
Can't be, I do.
Errol Morris is the writer and director of the movie The Thin Blue Line.
Ah.
He directed it as well?
Writer and director, yes.
Okay.
What followed was actually quite a good essay on the nature of truth, the fact that the truth does...
What was The Thin Blue Line about?
The Thin Blue Line is a movie about a convicted person who Morris believed may have been innocent. So he essentially reinvestigated the case, investigated the evidence that the police used and the attorneys used to convict him. And
It was a documentary.
The movie ultimately led to the release of this person from prison. So I thought it was interesting because Morris pretty eloquently summed up the skeptical philosophy. You know, the truth is out there, but the way to the truth is through, you know, careful logic and investigation. You know, we can't know metaphysical certitude, truth with a capital T, but we can come up with answers, and some answers are better than others. And that to me, is what the show is really all about. We're going to investigate and explore interesting, again, paranormal, pseudoscientific ideas and claims, and try to see where logic and the evidence takes us. And certainly we do believe that some answers are better than others. So did any of you read any of the news articles this week about the exploding toads in Germany?
Oh, I read
did
that.
See those,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, one of them.
It's interesting. I read about 20 of them, and they were all almost word for word the same. I think there was one article written about it that was in all of the papers were just pulling the same article off the APS. It's typical. So apparently in a pond in a city just north of Hamburg, hundreds or maybe as many as 1,000 or so toads have been observed to swell to enormous proportions and then just explode. Their guts simply fly out of them up to a meter, according to reports.
Yummy.
Interestingly, almost every headline was the same: exploding toads baffle experts, or some permutation of that. Experts are always baffled, I notice. They're never confused or... They're always baffled.
Yeah, you know, it paints the picture like these scientists in lab coats running around with, like, no idea what's
going on. They trump up the mystery angle of it, which the press
loves to do. The Keystone Cops of scientists.
I'm
picture
baffled.
That.
The conspiracy theorists and paranormal theorists were, you know, making light of it as well. A few people were talking about, you know, speculating about... you know, government experiments or whatnot, but they really didn't touch this one too much. I guess it'll take them some time to weave some tales about the exploding toad. So we'll see what emerges in the next week. But it was an interesting piece. The scientists do not have a good explanation for this so far. The working hypothesis is that they're suffering from a viral infection.
Well, you know, that does seem to make the most sense. You know, obviously, there's nothing supernatural going on, and I haven't heard anyone make the claim that it is something outside the bounds of what we would consider to be, you know, explainable. But,
yeah, not
you know, the thing that troubles me about the whole exploding frog thing is that the media is trying to sensationalize it, and no one really has anything to make it, you know, sensational other than the fact that these animals are blowing up.
I liken it to the quandary or puzzle years and years ago when they said that scientists could not explain how a bumblebee flies. I heard that for many years, you know, that story, until eventually, I think in the early 1990s or mid-1990s, a scientist eventually did come up with the explanation for it, and it met physics. There was nothing supernatural about it.
Exactly.
I kind of liken it to that.
I mean, how often have you heard people use that expression to, you know, to try to justify their superhuman feats, their supernormal, paranormal feats? Well, you know, scientists can't even prove that a bumblebee can fly. Therefore, I can do X. You know, it's just an easy way to justify their incredible supposed abilities.
And what do we call that logical fallacy?
Right, that's a logical fallacy.
That's argument from ignorance.
The argument from ignorance, and that is number two on our top 20 list of logical fallacies. Ad ignorantem. So we keep score on the Skeptic's Guide to logical fallacies. We have our top 20 logical fallacies on our website, which you can find at www.thenest.com. The argument from ignorance. So we can't explain how something works, therefore. Therefore, you can't prove that it's not true. Therefore, it must be true.
Right. I mean, and
it's,
the other,
it's unknown. Therefore, it's what we want it to be. What we want it to be.
Well, the other wrinkle that is kind of implied is that somehow, since the bumblebee does not know, you know, since the bumblebee does not know that scientists can't explain it, that somehow it's able to transcend, you know, the laws of nature and go beyond them. You know, with this ability, you know, it doesn't know that physics says it can't fly, so therefore he's going to, you know, fly anyway, you know, just with pure force of will, you know.
Yeah, even just using 10% of their brains.
Yeah, right. There you go.
Well, I think the implication is that scientists don't really know anything. That the fact that scientists cannot explain something doesn't mean that it's not true. It's basically just meant to say that science is not a good means to judge whether or not something is likely to be true or not. Which of course
does not mean unexplainable.
Well, that's right, and that's which is another logical fallacy.
Oh. On our list. Confusing. Oh, here's the classic example though. Back in was it the 70s or the 80s when pyramids were really big. A lot of people were saying, well, look at this pyramid. Look at the architecture. Nobody can possibly imagine that they could have achieved this. Therefore, aliens must have helped them.
Right.
Right.
And everyone believed it. Books were written about it. You know, aliens helped Egyptians construct the pyramids because
the
they couldn't conceive of
them?
The way it was done. and, of course, right around the time that was happening, they actually did determine a lot of the techniques that must have been used to construct the pyramids, and it faded away. And that's
right,
how it is with a lot of things.
Well, I find that a lot of times when something isn't explained, you know, to science's satisfaction, and first of all, a lot of people, like, they like that idea. It seems that also that they'll immediately jump to the most bizarre explanation. Like, it's not like, okay, well, we can't think of a reasonable way how they built these pyramids, so therefore it has to be something that is just so far out of the universe that it's, that, you know, to bring an alien, for example, is a very common thing that people do whenever something is unexplainable. And to me, the alien explanation is probably one of the most absurd because you're making a gigantic claim.
You're introducing a huge new assumption.
It insults Occam's razor.
Right. It is a violation of Occam's razor. Introduce new elements.
It's an insult. To and the other frogs. To, mm-hmm.
The other point of logic that I think is the bigger point of logic that ties all of this together is that there are different kinds of arguments and evidence that one can bring to bear on any claim. And you could think of them generally as negative arguments or positive arguments, or negative evidence versus positive evidence. And negative evidence, not knowing how something does work, or absence of evidence for a specific phenomenon, is always the weaker form of evidence, and it's always suspect. It always has a question mark next to it. Again, not knowing how the Egyptians built the pyramids, and therefore using that to speculate or to conclude,
right.
Even worse, that therefore they used psychic energy, or aliens helped them, or there was another ancient race that built it, whatever the belief is that you fill in the gap, that's always inherently very weak style of argument, as opposed to having positive evidence that aliens actually existed and were here and participated in the construction of the pyramids.
Well, I think we can agree that the media is pretty weak when it comes to understanding science, basically. Basic science.
Unfortunately.
Well, very weak.
You have to always consider the idea that the media is driven by sales.
Oh, yes.
It's a business. And anything that has to do with, as far as magazines or publications or any kind of mass-produced media is, to me, very untrustworthy because it boils down to somebody's income.
Now, talking about the media.
The point is, though, Jay, that most people get their information from the mass media. That's why it's mass. You simply have got to have in place the appropriate filters so that when this information comes flooding into you, and it's an ever-increasing volume day by day, you have to have the appropriate filters to be able to listen to the information and dissect it in a proper way.
Yeah,
and
right.
Filter out the nonsense.
Good point. What Carl Sagan, called the baloney detector.
Exactly. And that's right. One of the things we hope to do here.
It's critical thinking skills, something they don't teach in school, just rote memorization. And they don't teach people, they don't teach kids how to think.
And we one of the things we're going to try and do in the Skeptic Guide to the Universe is own your baloney detector.
Right. So, another interesting piece, you're talking about sensationalism in the media. What do you guys make of this headline? Reverse engineering extraterrestrial UFO flight patterns. Fast, completely erratic, and unpredictable with gaps in motion. So this is an article.
Quite a mouthful, first of all.
Article about analyzing the apparent patterns of UFO flight and then using this information to speculate about the physics behind it. It's accompanied by a photograph of a cloud, by the way, which is supposed to be, I guess, a spaceship, but I think anybody should be able to tell if this is simply a lenticular cloud, not uncommonly mistaken for UFOs.
How do you mistake a cloud for a UFO? I mean, I'm looking at the picture right now. It's got the classic saucer shape, and okay, yeah, you can kind of see it looks like a UFO, but my God, you're looking in the sky, and you see this immense object that's not moving, and you look a little more closely, and yeah, that's a cloud. I mean, how do you mistake that?
It's a cloud-like shape.
It's happened. It's happened in the past.
Oh, it
and
sure
it just
has.
It amazes me that these lenticular clouds, people think that they're UFOs.
Well, I'll tell you something. If I had a spaceship and I was flying in an alien's atmosphere, I would fly as erratically as possible just to confuse them. So that makes perfect sense to me.
But
the UFO was hiding inside the cloud. That's what I thought that was a picture of. I thought everyone knew it was a cloud.
The UFO's behind the cloud.
It's just such an incredible assumption for this article to start off by effectively saying, hey, UFOs are real. We don't even have to argue that. Let's talk about the physics behind it. It's just ridiculous.
It's the unstated major premise of the article is that UFOs are real. But my favorite line is, achieving navigation and stability while neutralizing gravity and electromagnetic properties of Earth over a local region is not easy.
Not easy. Neutralizing gravity.
That's
an understatement.
I'm going to get that tattooed to my forehead.
You know what else isn't easy? Apparently, being skeptical about these things apparently is also not easy.
Well, talk about wild speculation. I mean, they're going from an erratic pattern of movement, which, by the way, is much more easily explained as just optical illusions. And they're speculating about electromagnetic properties and neutralizing gravity. It's ridiculous.
The aliens obviously don't know that they can't neutralize gravity.
Right.
And that's what's empowering their ships.
Guys, let me tell you a quick story. That one of my favorite UFO stories. I read a few years ago. These three or four experienced pilots were walking to their plane, and they're just about to get on the plane, and they see something near the horizon that grabs their attention. It appears to be this unidentified flying object that is pulling maneuvers that just blows them away. 90-degree turns, incredible acceleration, deceleration, just totally amazes them that whatever this apparent craft is just pulling maneuvers that no jet fighter could do in its dreams. And they stayed watching it for a few minutes, and they're standing there contemplating their futures on the Oprah show, you know, making millions of dollars with this incredible event that they were witnessing, when the object dropped in the sky a little bit, got closer to the horizon, and then started to go behind a row of trees that were nearby. And instead of going behind it, it went in front of it. And immediately the illusion broke for them, and they realized that this wasn't a distant, huge object, but a very close, small object, like some floating flax seed or something that was just being buffeted by the winds. And it just goes to show that, I mean, these guys were experienced pilots, and even they were fooled by just a trick of nature, just something that just floating in the wind.
The brain. We're all susceptible to optical illusions.
Right. The, you know, the brain is a passive recorder. It's interpreting and trying to figure out at all times what exactly you're seeing, and that's where illusions come from, because your brain messes up.
Are you saying seeing is not believing, Bob? Is that
absolutely.
And
absolutely.
Also, you know, flight school doesn't teach you how to think critically.
No.
You don't have to be a critical thinker to be a pilot. And these guys obviously weren't.
Well, it's very, very difficult to become a pilot. There's a lot. You have to be an intelligent person to become a successful pilot, especially for an airline. But I agree with what you're saying, though, Perry. You're figuring that people that are flying airplanes that can potentially hold, today's standards, up to 800 people, that, you would want these people to just be brightly burning torches because of situations like that. But, you know, the sad fact is it's very common for pilots to make UFO claims as well. That's not uncommon.
Being intelligent is only one component of being a critical thinker.
Right, and there are different kinds of intelligence. I mean, having the intelligence to navigate and having good eye-hand coordination and to make judgment calls quickly when you're in the cockpit has absolutely nothing to do with understanding the nature of science and claims and logical fallacies and evidence. A friend of the family that we know is a commercial airline pilot. You know, he's a very good pilot by all accounts. He's also one of the most gullible people I know. He believes absolutely everything and doesn't have the toolkit to sort through claims like, UFOs.
Remind me not to fly on his plane, please. That's not
just
the pilot
the two
I
things
want.
Have, you know, the two things, and it also, again, a bigger issue is don't assume that because somebody has one intellectual skill set that they have another, that those tools apply to all types of intelligence or thinking or claims. They don't.
I'm sure you've met many or several physicians in
Yes.
Business.
Yes. I mean, for those in the audience who don't know, I'm a practicing physician, a neurologist. I deal with the brain and the nervous system, and medicine is science based, and getting through medical school, you have to learn some science. But some people still manage to get through it and to learn sort of the practical aspects of practicing medicine without really learning sufficiently the scientific underpinnings. And at the bottom of the heap of physicians can also be totally gullible and susceptible to errors in logic and thinking and not really understand how to evaluate evidence, or they're just overwhelmed by their personal philosophy or ideology. You know, we're all susceptible. Sometimes you want to believe something enough. It doesn't matter what your intelligence or your education is. You can the capacity for self-delusion is practically limitless.
True.
That's true for lots of skeptics. I know many skeptics, people that profess to be skeptics, that have a soft spot for one little bizarre belief that just makes my eyebrows raise, thinking, well, God, if you know a lot of this, all this other paranormal stuff is baloney, but you believe, you go to a chiropractor. I mean,
right.
what's sacred cow?
Yeah, how about
we had a close friend who was a pretty good skeptic, thought the UFOs were nonsense, Bigfoot and everything else. But one day I was talking to him, and he said, yeah, all that stuff is garbage. He said, but that voodoo, look out for that. He said, and I totally believed in voodoo. I mean, nothing else, apparently, of a paranormal nature, but boy, he sure believed in voodoo.
Perry, get closer to your microphone.
Also, another thing in this article.
Perry, you are very far away. Get closer to your microphone.
Remember, I'm breathing into it.
You've got to find a happy medium.
Yeah, just lower it, Larry. Perry, just lower it below your mouth. That's all.
Right, anyway, another thing in this article on the UFOs is multiple places. It starts off paragraphs by saying, according to scientists, according to many experts, engineers believe. Never once is there a mention of a name, what engineers, their institutions, what studies were done. It simply goes on and on about scientists, engineers, and experts.
Right. So it has a vague reference to authority without any specific reference. Always a red flag. And you're right, absolutely right. It's typical of this type of reporting. Experts say, or engineers believe, but there's
right.
not a single name, institution, specific reference that you can check up.
And that's
the media's not doing well.
That's a fallacy in itself, right? The argument from authority right
yes.
there.
Yes.
Right.
The media's not doing well
tonight.
Bolster your
argument by alluding to some vague authority figures. That
would be logical fallacy trust. Number three, the argument from authority. An authority figure says it's true, therefore it's true.
According to many experts, many countries are closely watching these flight patterns in designing their next generation of aircraft.
The next generation is right around the corner.
Yeah,
I'm going to put in a call to Boeing tomorrow and find out how many of their aeronautical engineers are watching these UFO
that,
clouds.
That makes no sense, though. How does that? How would they benefit from a UFO's flight pattern?
From wild speculation?
What do you mean? They're going to learn how to build the pulse neutralizer to get rid of gravity and electromagnetism. There you go.
Huh.
Well,
okay, thank goodness
on.
For the media.
Well,
huh?
Speaking of not making sense, the Kansas City Star reports on hearings that are being held this week in Topeka about defending evolution and whether or not intelligent design should be taught in Kansas public schools.
This is
an issue that won't go away. Although we seem to be in a flurry of such cases, this also comes at a time when Michael Behe has written an op-ed piece in the New York Times essentially defending intelligent design. Any of you read this piece?
Yes.
I've read it.
So we could pull out just some of his Behe's quotes from the article. I mean, essentially, it is a summary of what he has published in the past. There's really no new ideas in there. The essential claim of intelligent design is this: that life, biological organisms, look as if they were designed, and since we can't completely explain how they might have evolved, that therefore the only explanation left is that they were created by an intelligent designer, ID.
Steve, that sounds like another logical fallacy to me.
There's about five or six logical fallacies in there.
It's riddled with them.
It's riddled with me. We could go down the list.
That's an argument from ignorance.
It's the god of the gaps, argument from ignorance, argument from personal incredulity.
Begging the question,
confusing, unexplained with unexplainable, just off the top of my head.
I mean, isn't that incredible just in that 45 seconds? I mean, it was incredible. But.
So, Behe, in his book, Darwin's Black Box, gives as his prime examples of evidence for intelligent design what he calls irreducible complexity. So this means that there are structures in nature that could not possibly function if they were any simpler than they were. And therefore, they could not have evolved because evolution requires that they have passed through simpler stages. But how could they have been simpler if a simpler form could not have functioned? In fact, often on this show we will do questions that we have received. We have an Ask the Skeptic section on our webpage at thenest.com, and also listeners can send in their comments or questions. Simply visit our website or send an email to podcast@thenest.com. And maybe
got some real doozies in those questions.
We do, but here's one question that's on this topic. The question is, I recently read a book called Darwin's Black Box by Behe. Its thesis is that there are systems called irreducibly complex systems which appear to have no evolutionary advantage until all of their parts are present. And so would not seem to be candidates for evolving via natural selection through small changes. His conclusion is that these systems are evidence for intelligent design. I'd like to see an analysis of his example systems by a skeptic or hear a proposal for how such systems might have evolved. Now, we responded with a rather elaborate answer, but I'll hit the high points. The problem with that line of argument, essentially, is that irreducibly complex structures are, first of all, not irreducibly complex. So his premise is false. He uses the cilia of a bacterium as one example, that it could not function as this is the flagellum, the little tail-like appendage that they twirl around in order to move themselves through the water. And it has it's a little motor that swirls it around. And they say it could not function in that purpose if it were any simpler. Well, first of all, there are examples in nature that are simpler than the examples he gave that do function that way. So he simply was wrong. But even if it were true that it could not function as a flagellum, as a motor, if it were any simpler, that still does not mean that it could not have evolved for multiple reasons. First of all, it could have evolved from a simpler structure that served another purpose. Perhaps it was just an appendage that moved food particles closer to the cell so that it could absorb it. It could function in a much simpler form for that purpose. I'll bring up just one more thing, because then we could spend our entire hour just talking about this. But it also ignores the fact that biology is very, very messy. And one, it's not this perfectly constructed machine. And one of the things that is very messy about it is that genes which code for proteins, often through errors in replication when organisms are reproducing, undergoes gene duplication. So you know, an organism may have two or three or four genes for the same protein. This means that one of those genes can produce the protein in its original form, which will serve its original function. The other genes are redundant, and which means they're free to evolve in novel, random, and new directions. In essence, experimenting with new proteins and new structures that eventually could hit upon some new function. So the logic of his argument is completely false. But what's most interesting is that Darwin himself pointed out the flaws in this argument 150 years ago. We've known for 150 years that this is Paley's old argument, that it's flawed. But creationists, now under the guise of intelligent design, are really dredging up falsified ideas that have been shot down over a century ago, and yet they're passing it off as new scientific ideas.
It's because they only have to convince a school board panel that their idea has some sort of validity. You know, they don't have to go up toe-to-toe against the scientists who know better. They just have to impress a school board in order to get their agenda passed.
It's true. In Topeka, the education commissioner, a guy named Andy Tompkins, he appointed a 26-member committee to report to the board who were going to make this decision. And they came in with a draft that, you know, said that evolution is the proper way to teach, and it's going to tighten up the standards a little bit, but make no major changes. It's the minority report, the second
right.
report that was made by 8 members of this 26-member committee that is advocating the teaching of intelligent design and a much more critical look at evolutionary design.
Right, and watering down the teaching of evolution, too, not just introducing intelligent design, but watering down evolution by saying that it's just a theory, it's not proven, et cetera.
Right, and the guy behind, the force behind that is a guy out there named John Calvert, who was the founding director of the Intelligent Design Network of Shawnee Mission. That's a part of Kansas City. So, you know, he's one guy out there. He's the founding director of that network. And he got this railroaded through to the point now where they're going to have this hearing.
Right, they're an interest group. They're a vocal minority. But
the scientists
they can be influential.
In Kansas City, really, they looked far and wide for people to come testify. They're not going to testify because they say this is really nothing more than giving intelligent design people a showcase for their theories. I was wondering what we thought about that. You think that's the right thing to do? Not testify at the hearing?
I'm not sure if that's a good idea. My first inclination is to think that, you know, we got to get somebody in there to support science and evolution. But, you know, giving them a platform itself is not a desirable thing either. But so I'm not sure what to think on that one.
I agree that we shouldn't create platforms to debate creationists or ID proponents because that just plays into their hand. They don't deserve a platform side by side with legitimate scientists and legitimate science. And that's what they're looking for because it's a lot easier for them to confuse the public than it is for a proper scientist to educate the public. Dwayne Gish, who runs the Discovery Institute, a creationist think tank, likes to debate scientists about creationism because he knows that he can create more confusion, more inconsistencies in 5-10 minutes than it would take the scientists to correct in hours. There's even a term that has developed to refer to that called the Gish Gallop. He just spews out misconception after false fact after logical fallacy, and you there's no way you can get to it all. So it leaves the audience with this sense that, well, there's got to be something wrong with evolution because the scientist wasn't able to address all of Gish's claims. And this
right,
is the same thing. But I do think that when they have a platform, and when that platform is in front of a school board or is in court of law, we absolutely better represent the scientific side of things. We shouldn't give them a free pass.
Right. Well, they got one lawyer who's acting for free, who's going to be speaking.
But he's got no science background.
He doesn't, and he says he's not going to debate the question. It says in the article he's just going to show some exhibits and give a closing argument. And that's it. Kansas Citizens for Science, the pro-evolution people in the area, called for a boycott. They said don't do this. And most people apparently are agreeing with them, and no one's going to be there, I guess, except this Pedro Iragongeri. I'm sorry, butchering.
Well, it's an interesting strategy. We'll see how it plays out. We'll watch and learn. If it works, maybe it deserves replication.
Right,
If it doesn't work, we'll learn from this. But in the past, there are two things really have stopped the creationists from advancing. One is ridicule, like what happened over the last few years when school boards decide to either, you know, put stickers in textbooks or, you know, remove evolution from the science standards, the world turns its eye to that state or that county, and the ridicule pours in, and eventually it has an impact. The other thin line that prevents them from advancing their cause is the courts. Because in a court of law where there's rules of evidence, the creationists have no hope. They cannot, you know, as opposed to an open debate where they can create a lot of confusion, in a court of law where there's rules of evidence and arguing, they cannot stand toe-to-toe with, you know, the truth, with science and reason. Because
you
can't
say, I object at a debate, you know.
Well, you know, if you're going to debate creationists, you need to have a very controlled form, and rather than an open-ended debate. You need to be able to focus on very limited questions in enough detail for the truth to come out.
But generally, it's a bad forum. I would stay away from it.
Unless you know what you're doing, unless you can control the forum, it's usually a lose-lose proposition. But courts of law, so far, evolution wins every single time.
Steve, is this happening in other countries as well?
It's starting to.
It's primarily an American phenomenon,
right.
But it does, you know, this is one of those unfortunate things that America exports to other countries to some degree, like some other aspects of our
pseudoscience. In the United States, of course, religious conservatism is in the ascendancy. And there's a lot of reasons for that. But it is definitely in the ascendancy right now, and unfortunately, one of the offshoots of that is this more open forum for these creationist people. I mean, that's which is what they are. People want to call it intelligent design. It's another word for creationism. That's certainly the way I see it. The paragraph that I find most interesting in this piece says that the board held hearings in February on that first draft. Then it says this, I quote, "The board's conservative majority decided to hold the upcoming hearings to learn more about intelligent designs. The hearings will be before a three-member board subcommittee chaired by board chairman Steve Abrams, a conservative Republican from Arkansas City."
It's unfortunate that it's tied to one end of the political spectrum.
Definitely. I mean, you know, I think that they chose very deliberately to put that in this piece, the fact that the guy's a conservative Republican.
Right.
Who apparently decided to hear more intelligent design.
Matters of science should be divorced from politics in an ideal world. The only thing that really matters is what's the logic and evidence say. And evolution is established as well as any theory in science. It is a scientific fact. Intelligent design is a house of cards. It is a house of logical fallacies. Again, many claims that have been shown to be false over a century ago. But, you know, that never stopped the creationists from using it as an argument.
Well, we'll have to follow this and see if this boycott is a good way of dealing with it.
It'll be interesting to follow, and I'm sure Jeannie Scott, who, you know, for those of you who don't know, Jeannie Scott, runs a national organization that is basically the primary watchdog on creationism and the attempts, you know, grassroots attempts to get creationism taught in public schools. So I'm sure her organization and her people will watch this closely as well. There is a magician.
Is he Egyptian?
He's not Egyptian. That what is his name? Nu. Any of you familiar with him? Now there are many magicians, and they can do seemingly fantastical feats. But some of them claim that their feats are actually paranormal in nature, while others admit coyly that it's merely a trick, an illusion.
Well, Uri Geller is a prime example of that. Of basically claiming that his magical ability is, you know, his sleight of hand ability is actually magic mind power mentalist.
Now be careful.
Careful what you say about him. You don't want to get sued now.
If you don't believe that he does his magic tricks through miracles, he'll sue you.
Well, maybe anyone, I don't know, 45 or older might be familiar with the name Uri Geller. I mean, certainly Uri Geller is well past his heyday and past his celebrity, at least in the United States. However, there's a gentleman who has a show that's been airing lately on the Learning Channel. His name is Alain New, and his show is called The Mysterious World of Alain New. So I was channel surfed, so follow me. I was channel surfing the other night, and I came across his program, and he's doing some pretty impressive street magic. I love magicians. I love magical tricks, and I know most skeptics do. So I stopped to watch his show for a little while. I'm watching the show for about 15 minutes or so, and Elaine has just performed the Mentalist trick for some observers in the street. Now, I can't quote exactly what he said, but he's telling his audience that he's using the power of mental energy to fuel his tricks. Well, this, of course, piqued my interest a lot more due to this comment. I continued to watch the show. I watched it to its end, another 30 minutes or so. During the course of that time, Elaine must have used words and phrases such as energy, chi, psychic, mental power, a half dozen times or so, if not more. I wish I had my VHS deck running during the show so I could actually pull the exact quotes that he said for this show. But was he
representing it as a show, or was he kind of instructing people, or was he like trying to sell it off as he was really doing it? What was the feel of the show?
It's much like if anybody has seen what David Blaine has done in his street magic performance and how that show is edited for television and presented to the people. This is essentially the exact same thing.
So it was presented as if it's real, then.
Sounds more so, even though.
Right. Exactly. So, but you know, but the problem with Elaine, David Blaine, some other people like this, is that here we have a talented magician. He's making a very entertaining program for the viewers, and his tricks were excellent. No doubt about it. Those tricks were really, really good. He has to go ahead and invoke his pseudoscientific terms, energy, chi, and so forth, to his awestruck audience to explain how the magic is happening. And good skeptics should be upset when they see this happening, especially on a nationally televised program.
Now, the thing is, though, there is a gray zone here because, you know, traditionally magicians, you know, it's all stage presence and they have to create a mystique about them. And they will often, you know, play act at saying that their powers are mysterious and mystical. And so magicians will often do that. Now, how do you know he is, you know, earnestly trying to convince the public that he has chi and mystical magical powers versus just play acting at the stage magician?
I went to the internet. Thank goodness for the internet. Now there wasn't. I wish I could have found more in my search, but I did find a few things, a few quotes, a few phrases attributed to Elaine. And let me just share a few of these with you real quick, so you can understand a little bit better where I'm coming from. So in an interview, he was asked about how he does a spoon bending trick. Here we go with Geller, who made that phenomenon famous.
Yuri Geller was made famous on his spoon bending trick, which can be replicated by any trained magician. And you know, our friend James Randi certainly delights in bending spoons to show how simple it can be done. In fact, he says if Yuri Geller is bending spoons with mystical, magical energy, he's doing it the hard way.
Exactly. Elaine claims that his spoons are bent by his chi-charged fingertips. Actually, chi, which is short for qigong, which is an ancient Chinese energy balancing exercise of some sort. And that's his claim as to why the spoons...
Now Evan, bend. Is it actually an ancient Chinese secret?
I think only the ancient Chinese could answer that, Steve.
Okay,
so we're going to have to find some elderly Chinese men or women.
Obviously, you know, he's not using any kind of supernatural powers to do this. He's a magician. He's a very good magician. And the only concern that I have is if this show isn't really couched in, it's entertainment. It's part of the allure of the show that he's, you know, he's pretending that it's real when we all know it really isn't. If it's coming off much more like the way that Yuri Geller does it, which is, you know, I'm really doing this. I've gone on talk shows, and I, you know, it really has a personality of this is for real. It's a completely different show then.
Well, Jay, I'll tell you what. Here's how I sum it up. Here's what I think after I was done watching that show. What people like Elaine and maybe David Blaine failed to realize that what they're really doing
is, yes, they're entertaining people with their tricks and so forth, but really, the bottom line is that they're enhancing the audience's belief in pseudoscience and fantasy, whether they know it or not, willingly or not. That's what people are walking away from when they see this performance. And he starts attributing these simple tricks that people like Penn and Teller or James Randi could easily also replicate and not invoke any sort of pseudoscience as to why it's happening. He goes ahead and he just totally undermines himself and his profession by attributing it to these special forces. And that this is the problem I have with this. And I think that's the harm that someone like Elaine New causes. And certainly the Learning Channel of all places.
Well, it kind of makes him a snake oil salesman, you know? You know, I mean, basically it reduces him to selling something that has absolutely, you know, no special effect.
May I make one more quote I found on Elaine off the internet? Here you go. Here's a direct quote from him. "Science cannot explain what I do. Many people have tried to guess. I am just an ordinary man. I do not try to explain myself."
Which is backed up by what your quote from New, Evan.
Yes.
That you just gave. Is unfortunately braced and backed up, no pun intended, as you'll hear in a second, by Eric Brace of the Washington Post, no less. I looked the guy up. He's the art editor at the Washington Post. He reviews art museums. And he wrote that this is the quote on News homepage, right underneath his picture, featured very prominently. It says this: "To watch him is to throw out all the rules of physics. Time and space are malleable in News deft hands."
Steve, you know what you
that's
want
what
to
Eric
do?
Said from the Washington
Steve,
Post.
You should
well,
post
open
a
up
formal
to,
challenge
to interpretation.
To this guy. Steve, do what Randi did to Uri Geller. Just say, okay, you know, let's put your money where your mouth is.
Well, we could, you know, certainly, you know, formally challenge him with the Randi $1 million psychic challenge.
That's a great idea.
You know,
he's not going to put himself.
Whenever these people are called out like this, they in public say, "Yeah, absolutely, I'll do it," and then they never, ever, ever do it because you
that's
know why? Because
right.
they know they're cheating,
yeah,
and the ones
right.
that know that they're doing magic tricks,
right,
will never subject themselves to another magician who knows
not
how they're doing,
years.
Who knows how they're doing what they're doing.
Elaine even in something else I read on him, he knows who James Randi is. And he describes James Randi as one of his early inspirations as to getting into the magic performance business.
My God.
Right. So he certainly is well aware of James Randi, and
yeah.
I'm sure he doesn't want to go anywhere near him.
Of course. So, I mean, he's clearly over the line with that. I mean, David Blaine, I think, just flirts with the I'm a mystical aura kind of magician. Uri Geller is a con artist, let's face it. This guy sounds like he's somewhere in between those two guys. But I mean, this is.
I don't know, Steve. I don't know because if you're like doing a palm reading or readings, doing a séance possibly, or I mean, there's a lot of parts of paranormal phenomena where the person can actually be self-deluded and actually think, yeah, I've really got something going on here. But somebody like him, you've got to consciously be doing these tricks. I mean, you've got to know, well, yeah, I'm doing the trick this way, but I'm saying this other way. That's conscious.
I agree it's totally conscious. I'm saying the degree to which he's using it, I mean, he's just using it to enhance his stage presence as opposed to, like, deliberately con people out of money. Uri Geller was using dowsing, you know, was accepting $1 million commissions from company to tell them where to dig wells. Using his dowsing ability, at least so he by his own claims. So, I mean, if you want to talk about conscious, you know, using the mentalist or magician tricks consciously, in order to sell yourself to the world as a paranormalist, let's talk John Edwards. I mean, he's the king of them all.
Yeah, he's done the best out of
and,
all of them.
I mean,
is he still on TV?
John Edwards has the show Crossing Over for a while. I don't think he's on anymore.
I believe it was canceled.
It was canceled.
I think it's canceled.
That's awesome. Why didn't we have a party?
What channel was that on?
He claims to channel or to be able to see the dead and to speak to the spirits of the guests who are there, the people who are in his studio. And what he really does is a sloppy cold reading. Now, Again, for those of you who don't know, a cold reading is simply starting with general statements that are likely to be true about most people, you know, making a lot of guesses, and then when you get positive feedback, when you hit upon something that's accurate, you get the positive feedback from the person you're giving the reading to. And
give
then
an example,
you proceed. So Edwards will say, I see an older female figure associated with you. I'm getting the letter M is in her name. Mom. And then, the person may volunteer. They might say, Mary. He's like, yes, Mary. The name is, you know, so, and this has been made fun of in many, many venues. Of course, the best of which is South Park, the South Park episode about John Edwards.
Yes.
But,
oh, classic.
Awesome.
So the thing is, this is a mentalist trick that's been around for hundreds of years. And it's using simple, you know, deception and misdirection and illusion to make it seem as if you have special knowledge that you don't have. That's what mentalism is all about.
Right, and don't forget that it's also a two-way street. There's also human psychology that comes into play. You've got things like selective validation, where it's just part of human psychology that, you know, if someone throws 20 wild-ass guesses at you and hits two of them,
yeah.
I mean, that's pretty bad. That's pretty bad guessing. But generally, you will go away thinking, wow, he's so accurate, and you'll only remember the hits,
right.
And you'll forget the misses.
And also,
and,
you know, his show is heavily edited.
Yeah.
You know, they really, they
oh,
they,
God, I believe
they
it.
They shoot 3 hours and they reduce it down to an hour. At least that's the way they did do
yeah.
it.
I mean, by report, he also worked the audience ahead of time. And he did more than a cold reading. He cheated.
Right.
You know, he did a warm reading. There's even reports that he, there was, you know, I don't have his name handy, but a fellow skeptic went into the audience just to see it firsthand. And he reported that his answers were clipped. So he had the answer to one question, which was spliced together with another one. So it made it seem as if he was agreeing with something that he never agreed to. So, I mean, that's just blatant cheating. But someone who's halfway decent at cold reading could do a better job than John Edward did in pretending to talk to the dead. But the other thing that's clear is that because of the techniques that he's using, we know he's consciously lying. He's not self-deluded. He's lying.
Right,
and it goes all back to the fact that it made him rich, and it brought that station in a ton of money, and the station's media just does not care what the truth is.
The Sci-Fi Channel actually produced
initially,
it, you know?
Yeah, but then I think
right.
But it was canceled
yeah.
over a year ago.
Yeah, too much fiction, not enough right. science.
Wow.
Well, how about the woman, the pet psychic? My favorite
oh, yeah.
all-time thing that she said, every once in a while I'd catch 10 minutes of it, as long as I could stomach it. My favorite thing was, this guy had a pet alligator, and she said, oh, your alligator's hungry. And
that's
what
a stretch.
Tried to tell you. Wow.
That's a stretch.
She's pretty brilliant.
Good. I wonder
anyway,
if he got sleepy later. I mean, that's remarkable.
I'd like to say, everyone, you should all go to www.randi.org. That's James Randi's site. There's a ton of information on there that's definitely worth looking into.
A wonderful resource. A wonderful resource.
Yeah, after you go to the Nest, go to randi.org.
Yes, go to the
definitely.
Nest first.
Hey, Evan, let me... I was looking at your write-up on this new guy, and
yes.
there's one quote that jumped out at me that I think you got off the Internet. He was saying here, and I just wanted to mention it with a brief response. He said something about, I think it's important to be skeptical. To be skeptical is to be open, but to completely close your mind off to something that doesn't seem rational is not exactly skeptical.
That is a quote.
That's a straw man argument right there. I mean, a true skeptic does not just turn their minds off to something that doesn't seem rational. If they did, then quantum mechanics would seem to be hogwash.
It's not just that.
It's also evidence.
Right.
It's evidence. Quantum mechanics has plenty of evidence. Ouija boards don't, period.
Well,
and that's it. And that's a key thing he's missing. And you know,
here's another person who just really doesn't understand what skepticism is. He doesn't.
No,
he thinks he does.
Well, we don't know that.
Doesn't.
We also not care because he's selling something.
Yeah,
this is his magic persona. We don't know how much he believes he's saying.
Right.
But that statement is a cliche. It's very standard. The idea is that skeptic scientists are closed-minded to the possibilities of the paranormal and whatnot. That's in a sense an ad hominem logical fallacy. It's basically saying saying that we're wrong because we're closed-minded, right. You know, because we're not open to these possibilities. But
well, shame
right.
on him.
Yeah,
shame
right.
on him.
Either way, or, either he's deluded or lying. Either way, shame on him. I agree.
So that reminds me of a great little thing I heard. I forget a few years ago. That's you know, it's great to have an open mind, but not so open that your brains fall out.
That's the difference between having an open mind and having a hole
right.
in your head.
Right. Well, I think I've argued in the past that it's actually the people who make these claims who are closed-minded, because they're
right.
closed to the possibility that their claims are wrong. And that's the hardest lesson that scientists have to learn
right.
is that the evidence can show that they're wrong. And when it does, that is when their heart and soul as a scientist is truly tested. And the good ones, the ones that are respected, the ones that you know can stand up and face their peers, are the ones who, when proven wrong, say, all right, this claim is wrong, let me go on with my life. But the true believers, the paranormalists, do not do that. When you show them evidence that their claim is wrong, they dismiss it, they deny it, they're totally closed to it. They refuse to even consider the possibility that their cherished belief might be wrong.
The oh, beliefs man. That you hold the most dear are the ones you should question
the greatest.
The
That's
most.
Absolutely correct.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's true.
And also, who is this guy going to be our loser of the week?
Sure, why don't we make him the loser of the week?
Our gullible loser of the week, Elaine New.
Elaine New. Look him up. Or not.
Absolutely.
For a laugh, maybe, but that's it. Don't buy his products.
Fortunately, you can watch his show. Well, hopefully it'll go the way of John Edwards. Be canceled after its four-episode run.
We can hope, but let's face it. The appeal of the paranormal, of mystery mongering, is far greater than the appeal of cold, rational logic and science, which is a shame. Because science is fascinating.
Yeah,
science
is
the you know the most liberating, interesting, fascinating things in the world. I mean, the most bizarre ideas that have been thought of by human beings are things like quantum mechanics and black holes and you know the fact that all the information necessary to make a person is curled up in every little cell in our body. I mean, these things are much, much more fantastical than anything the paranormal gurus have to say.
And in a
Absolutely.
Much simpler and in a much simpler scenario here, I think magical tricks are fascinating.
Yeah,
good magicians,
are.
The Penn and Tellers,
right.
the James Randis, the Harry Andersons of the world.
Good
then they don't
rely. Good skeptical literature is great too. It all has a place. It just doesn't have a place in being your guide to living your life. To what's real,
and
to what's
it,
true.
And it
to the
certainly
universe.
shouldn't be taught as science in the science classroom. Of our schools.
Absolutely.
Agreed. Well, that's right. That's the most
but, you know,
important,
it's, you know, we're talking about the media and these television shows, and it does bring up the point that although, you know, we fight passionately over what passes for science in the public schools, and we should, but in reality, people learn a great deal more, and their beliefs are shaped far more by what they see on television and now on the internet and on computers than what they learn in the classroom. So, and we
well,
have
certainly.
Absolutely lost the battle for the hearts and souls of the mass media, because what they sell mystery mongering, they sell sensationalism, and they love the paranormal, and they just do not have the desire, the inclination, or the patience for good science.
And didn't Jennings just last month do some big show on
yeah.
UFOs that was
yeah,
totally, totally credulous, or at least
it was
credulous.
Mostly credulous. There were the skeptics had their say, but it was almost token skepticism. They really didn't do a balanced job, which was disappointing. Previously, Jennings had done a piece on the JFK assassination, and he came to a very hardcore skeptical conclusion. There's no conspiracy. There's no evidence for a conspiracy. All the evidence points to a lone shooter, you know, the lone nut theory, Lee Harvey Oswald acting on his own. And he said that's what the evidence shows, and that was the premise of the whole show. I was hoping he was going to take the same approach to UFOs, but he didn't. He spent the bulk of his time letting the true believers really ramble unopposed.
Hey, well, Stone Phillips on Dateline NBC just about a week ago ran a bit on showing a live exorcism. And
really?
Yeah, and the thing that, you know...
Lame.
I have
so
to admit,
lame.
You know, I... There's something about an exorcism that I find curious, and I can understand from a programming perspective why they would want to do a show like that. But the thing that I really don't like is these reporters, they do that whole thing where they don't commit. They show, like, half the show is, you know, the people who are performing the exorcism and their whole routine and kind of giving them some credibility, and then, you know, they mix in there the skeptical people, and then you walk away.
But
like,
who knows
not knowing
what's really true?
Yeah, and it's up to you
to decide.
The viewer.
Oh, they think that that's balanced reporting, but if you balance total and utter nonsense with logic and evidence, you don't. That's not balanced reporting. That's elevating nonsense to the status of evidence and logic and science.
Right.
Steve, that's
who
scary.
Do you like? What reporters do you like? Especially
well,
like,
John Stossel. John Stossel deserves kudos.
Yeah,
he's excellent.
I've seen a bunch of his stuff.
You know, Scientific American Frontiers, excellent program. Very good. Bill Nye the Science Guy, good
show.
Scientist, good skeptic, good educator.
He's coming out with a new show, I think.
So there are bright spots out there, and I think though.
Yeah, what about in Surgeon?
Come on, Spock did that one.
I was mesmerized by that show as a kid. I mean, Spock could have said anything.
Yeah. And it sounded logical. It has to be logical. That was the worst piece of crap reporting ever to stain the airwaves. It really was.
Oh, boy.
I mean, they.
That's a bold
statement. Bob, have you seen it recently? I've seen some episodes.
No, not
recently
but there's a lot of crap out there.
But the thing that it's not that this was. I don't think this was a show that was produced by true believers or just naive reporters thinking that they have to give a balance between nonsense and science. They totally distorted the evidence to manufacture, alleged mysteries. It really was. Shameless manipulation.
That show was worse than the $6 Million Man. If you catch one of those reruns, you're going to shoot yourself. Horrible.
Really?
Painful. Like, you watch it and you're watch this show?
Yeah.
Oh, I love that show.
Yeah, Bob, it's terrible.
Oh, I believe it. I'm sure it didn't age very well.
I think we're out of time. Thanks for listening. This was the first podcast of The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe with... our rogues gallery of skeptics once again, Perry DeAngelis, Evan Bernstein, Bob Novella and Jay Novella, and I'm your host, Stephen Novella. We all run the New England Skeptical Society. You could take a look at our articles on the web at www.thenest.com. You can also look at our podcast page, which has more links and information about the topics that we talk about. Send us your questions and topics and whatever you want to hear us talk about. Send email to podcast@thenest.com. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.